Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Kirk Megu, host of Politics and Polemics on the New Books Network. I also host my own podcast called Independent Thought and Freedom, where I interview some of the most interesting people from around the world who are shaking up politics, economics, society, and ideas. You can find it in the iTunes Store or on any one of your favorite podcast providers. You can also subscribe to my YouTube channel. Also, are you an academic that wants to get heard nationally? Check out my free training on 3 steps how to use your intellectual authority to become a media personality at becomeapublicintellectual.com. That's becomeapublicintellectual.com. You can find the links below. And now, on to this week's episode. Hi. Today, my guest is Catherine Stewart, author of the new book, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism, published by Bloomsbury in 2019. Catherine Stewart is an American journalist and also the author of The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children in 2012. Her writing has been published in the New York Times, The Guardian, The American Prospect, Reuters, The Atlantic, Newsweek, Rolling Stone, Santa Barbara Magazine, and other outlets. Welcome, Catherine.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. I'm talking to you from Trinidad and Tobago. It's warm and sunny here. What about you? Where are you located?
I'm in the New York area, and it's warm and sunny here as well. Thank you.
Very good. Well, can you just tell, the way we like to start off is just for you to tell our listeners a little bit about your background, particularly as it relates to the book.
Sure. Well, you know, if you had told me 15 years ago I was going to start focusing on the religious right, politics, and policy in my work, I really would not have believed it. But I started to get interested in this topic in 2009. I was living with my family in Santa Barbara, California, and something called a Good News Club came to my children's public elementary school. I had a daughter in the first grade at the time. Good News Clubs are designed to convert very little children in their earliest years of learning, often too young to read, into a deeply fundamentalist form of evangelical Christianity. And they confuse little kids into thinking the public school endorses their form of religion. They encourage children attending the clubs to proselytize and recruit their classmates. So I was really astonished to learn there were thousands of these clubs operating in public schools nationwide. But I was quite naive at the time. They claimed to be non-denominational, and I thought that meant non-sectarian. And I actually think it's fine to teach about religion, even in public schools, from a non-sectarian standpoint. You can teach about the Bible, as history or as literature, or as sort of you can talk about different kinds of mythology, as my children have learned in their public schools, learning about different religious traditions and the different mythologies that they teach. But when I learned that they were really a sectarian group that was intended to proselytize children in public schools, in a diverse public school setting, this seemed quite inappropriate to me. It seemed the arrival of the club was very divisive in our own public school community. But the more I learned about the clubs and the movement behind them, the more concerned I became. So I was really stunned to learn about the movement's legal sophistication, its determination, and its coherence, and very, very high level of strategic thinking. The appearance of the clubs had been deemed legal because of the legal strategy, a very particular legal strategy. So I got really interested in how they were, you know, how it was possible that they were in public schools and what they represented. And the more I learned about them, I realized that Good News Clubs were really just one part of a larger attack on public education as a whole.
And you were a journalist at the time.
Right. I mean, I got my start in investigative reporting early in my career. I was an intern for the great investigative journalist Wayne Barrett at the Village Voice and continued to do some investigative work. But, you know, I got married, had a couple of kids. I published a couple of novels. I co-wrote with a friend a book about the musical Rent. And I was just kind of on a different track at the time that we were living in Santa Barbara. And this,
I also think it's probably interesting to point out that you also are not from a Christian background, correct?
That's true. My family is Jewish, and my husband was raised in a Catholic family. So as a sort of interfaith family, I, you know, have always enjoyed different aspects of our religious traditions. And when we were
living in... similar to me. I mean, I'm a Hindu, but my father is Catholic, and so we grew up in a multi-religious household, and I could understand how personally, you know, when you're dealing with proselytizing events in school, how that could be an issue.
Well, the interesting thing is it's not sort of exclusive issue for just religious minority groups. I mean, even Christianity in America is incredibly diverse, and the arrival of the club proved really divisive, even in a diverse Christian community. Neighbors fought bitterly about it. Our school was in the same district as an evangelical college, the Westmont College, but most of my friends who were school moms were affiliated with Westmont in some way. They were either professors themselves or wives of professors. And a lot of them were really upset about the arrival of the club in our community as well. Evangelicalism is diverse. They thought it was really inappropriate for them to be proselytizing one particular strain of religion in the public school. So a number of these parents, Westmont-affiliated parents, actually met with the leaders of the Good News Club and said, you know, we're Christians too, but we really don't think you're right in a diverse school community. Diverse in terms of Christian faith and also other faiths. And the Good News Club leaders declined. They insisted on being in the public school. Interestingly, they were actually offered free and better space in the evangelical church that was literally next door to the school at the same time. And they declined. Right. They insisted on being in the school. And that's really what got me questioning, who are the people behind the Good News Clubs? What do they really believe? And why don't they want to be in the church? Why are they insisting on being in our public school? And that set me on that larger path.
So how much is this book a sequel to that? Is it very much a sequel? Does it go off on another tangent? So what's the relationship between the two books?
Well, the first book really focused on public education, but my current book, The Power Worshippers, shows that is really focused on the larger attack on America as a modern constitutional democracy. And I got really interested. Look, I think a lot of would-be defenders of democracy today don't really have a clear understanding of what they're up against. I wanted to remedy by pulling the curtain, if you will, on the religious rights leading organizations and most intriguing personalities, key organizations. It's religious right is made up of a number of organizations like, you know, policy groups, legal advocacy groups, data organizations. They've invested for decades in all of the infrastructure of modern political campaigns. I think if you look at the effect of their work, people sometimes ask how much power do they really have. I think we can look at the 2016 election of Donald Trump. He would not have won without this movement's support. They put the machinery of their movement behind him. So they have a really impressive get out the vote machine. And so I kind of wanted to unpack that by showing how it works.
Okay. Now, one of the key concepts in the book, or the key ideas, is Christian nationalism. Although the title is religious nationalism, but it's really focusing on Christian nationalism, correct? Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Could you define that for us and just explain why that's important?
Sure. The thing to know about religious nationalism or Christian nationalism is that it's, first of all, not a single religion. It's a political ideology. Its representatives insist that the foundation of legitimate government is bound up with a reactionary understanding of a particular religion. Christian nationalism essentially says that the United States is based on the Bible, not on the Constitution, and that we really need have to somehow get back to our nation's Judeo-Christian or Christian founding. Sometimes they call it Judeo-Christian. So it's really an anti-democratic movement. It's anti-pluralist and it's anti-equality. It says that the U.S. can succeed only if it stays true to this religious foundation. Now, Christian nationalism is also a device for mobilizing and often manipulating large segments of the public for controlling their vote and for concentrating power in the hands of a new elite. I want to say something else about what the movement is not. It's not just about evangelicals. A lot of people characterize this as a white evangelical movement. That's not complete. The movement includes many evangelicals, but it also excludes many evangelicals. And it includes many varieties or representatives of both Protestant and non-Protestant religion. What unites the movement is not so much a distinct theology, but a common political vision.
Now, a lot of people would be familiar, especially, I suppose, older listeners, let's say the moral majority, you know, big in the 1980s and whatnot with Ronald Reagan. Do you see that moral majority movement as being part of this Christian nationalism, or do you see Christian nationalism as something new?
It's an extension of many of the movements of the past, the so-called moral majority, or what many leaders of a political movement called the New Right have played a key role in the development of what we're seeing with today's hyper-political religious right and incredibly empowered religious right. I would say uniquely empowered religious right or Christian nationalist movement. So that movement started up in the 80s when a number of thinkers, including Paul Weyrich, Richard was the founder of the Heritage Foundation, Richard Vigri, Jerry Falwell was part of it, Phyllis Schlafly was involved. They were really unhappy about the direction the culture was taking. A lot of them were very upset about the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement. They were concerned about issues related to prayer in schools. But one of the key issues that animated that movement in its earlier days was a fear that racially segregated academies might be deprived of their lucrative tax exemptions. At the time, the IRS was starting to look at these racially segregated religious schools and saying, you know, questioning, why are they getting their tax exemptions? So Jerry Falwell and many of his fellow Southern white conservative pastors were really upset about this. They were you know, as far as they were concerned, they had a right not only to segregate people, but also to receive federal money for the purpose. So they kind of coalesced around this fear that the Supreme Court might end these tax exemptions. But they knew that this wasn't really going to be an effective rallying cry to inspire a kind of broad-based, hyper-conservative counter-revolution. They were really unhappy with the liberalism of what they saw as infused into the Republican Party at the time. So they sort of went down a laundry list of what they thought might unite their movement. We're talking like around 1979 or so. This is around 6 years after Roe versus Wade. So I guess the movement actually coalesced, we should say, in the 70s rather than the 80s.
Yeah.
So they sort of went down this list of issues that they might be able to use to unite their movement, you know, thinking about civil rights and women's rights and prayer in schools. And then they kind of got to abortion and they basically said, wow, that could work. So, you know, what happened is over time, they were able with the abortion issue to unite conservative Protestant and conservative Catholic membership and draw in, as one of the members of the New Right said, some of our fringe friends and create this new hyper-conservative movement that sort of drew the Republican Party to the right. We have to remember at that time how the party, they knew if you can get people to vote on a single issue, you can control their vote. So if you can sort of unite everyone around one issue, you can basically control their vote. Let's remember at the time when Roe v. Wade was passed and abortion was legalized, most Protestant Republicans supported it. There was a piece that ran in the Southern Baptist Convention's wire service that actually hailed the decision. They had passed resolutions approving of abortion law liberalization. Ronald Reagan passed the most liberal abortion law in the country in 1967. And figures like Betty Ford hailed Roe v. Wade as a great, great decision. But activists like Phyllis Schlafly and Paul Weyrich saw the potential for this issue to sort of unite this new movement and over time purge those pro-choice voices from the Republican Party. And it was a way of sort of dragging the party off to the right. And, you know, there were other activists involved, Ralph Reed, Richard Viguerie in many ways. They sort of worked in other lines of developing the movement. But over time, it's really come to a point where we're now seeing unprecedented political power.
Right. So just to kind of clarify, so the term Christian nationalism, the groups themselves that you're talking about in the book, they don't actually use that term for themselves, do they?
You know, I use a lot of different terms in the book. I use the term religious nationalism in the title because I wanted to make clear the movement's similarities with other forms of religious nationalism around the world. And in fact, I report that in the book. I report on, in my chapter 12, I go in, among others, I go into what they call the so-called global conservative movement, which is has declared a war on global liberalism. I use that term because I wanted to show that this is not just an American phenomenon. It's it bears common features with other forms of religious nationalism around the world. So when we see leaders like Putin in Russia, for instance, or Orban in Hungary, or Erdogan in Turkey, binding themselves to religious conservatives in their countries in order to consolidate a form of a more authoritarian form of political power, we rightly recognize that as a form of religious nationalism. And I think that's what we're seeing today with Trump's alliances with our own religious hyper-conservatives.
Okay. Now, I know you're focusing on the Christian nationalism, but in the United States, how would you differentiate it from, let's say, you know, radical Islamic movements that might be calling for Sharia law, or maybe, you know, Zionists who, you know, seek to influence American foreign policy in Israel? Do you see it as part of that same family, or do you see this as something different?
I think there are different features. Different places have different features, obviously, in different parts of the world. But I think that These types of religious nationalism have been used over time and throughout history to consolidate a more authoritarian form of political power. And what's really interesting about it is that it doesn't always rely, like the leader isn't always himself, and it's always, almost always a him, right? Doesn't always embody these religious values. So if you think about Mussolini, who is like an atheist, you know, who happily fathered a child out of wedlock, and yet he was imposing sort of Catholicism as a state religion in Italy, and he was an authoritarian leader. And we think about people like Franco, who sort of in Spain, who did the same thing. So this is a type of thing that has been used over time.
Yeah, and today, I mean, you see that with Trump and Matteo Salvini, for example, in Italy. Yes. Yeah, that it's interesting that, you know, the people who champion the church as I don't know, I suppose a part of traditional society may not necessarily be the most pious of people.
That's true. I mean, that's the thing. Even if you're not yourself exactly a model rule follower, you are still seen as a champion of hierarchies, of custom, tradition, gender, and family. I mean, right-wing authoritarians believe in rules, but they don't believe in the rule of law. And that's another reason why I think, you know, religious conservatives tend to come to their side. America's culture warriors might talk a good game about religious liberty and government tyranny and their unwavering commitment to the Constitution. But the leaders, they actually, I think, would be happy to sort of trash the Constitution if it fails to deliver what they want it to deliver. And we think about Trump doesn't appear to have much respect for the Constitution. You know, it's interesting. People often call them religious conservatives. I think sometimes the language is difficult because sometimes it's hard to know exactly what we're looking at. But if we think about, you know, whether this is a movement that's genuinely conservative, a genuinely conservative movement would want to preserve institutions of value that have been crafted over centuries of American history. It would prize, for instance, the integrity of electoral politics. It would seek to protect the vote. Religious nationalists in America are actually engaging in race-based gerrymandering and voter suppression. They're trying to degrade the vote. President Trump himself said in an audio call, if everybody who voted, then a Republican would never win. Richard Vigri himself, we spoke about him a little earlier. He's one of the leaders in the New Right. He's got you can actually find it. You can see audio, video of him saying, I don't want everyone to vote. Our influence in elections goes down when the number of people voters go up. You know, I mean, think about a real conservative movement would actually value the legitimacy of the judiciary. Unfortunately, religious conservatives don't. They have no trouble stealing seats and packing the court as long as it gives them the rulings that they want.
Yeah, I think it's an important point you make. A couple of those points you raised there and expanded on, and I'd like to perhaps expand a little further. I'm interested in a lot of the ideas behind it as well as the historical timeline that really takes up the bulk of your book. But on the ideas part, I think it's very important what you just said, that the language is difficult. And then, you know, you have these, you know, this thing about, I like that distinction you make about, you know, believing in rules versus the rule of law. I suppose you're talking about the process they find difficult or objectionable in that sense. That liberal process, but even like you talk about conservatism, that's something I've thought about a long time. You know, what Americans call conservative is certainly not what in the French Revolution or in England what they would call conservative. It's really a kind of 19th century liberalism in America that is kind of conservative. And then things like even the idea of nationalism. I'm wondering if even the term nationalism is correctly applied to the movement. And I know you use terms like theocracy. I don't know if theocracy is also the exact so word. Much,
actually, no, I don't. Look, I think when we're understanding, you know, trying to understand the movement, well, there's so much to say here. First, I'm going to say it's really hard to talk about the political aspects of religious groups without appearing to bash religion. And there is a distinction. You know, my interest is not in criticizing religion. It's really in trying to help people understand that what they call religion is often really partisan agitation and partisan activism. I do think it's really helpful in trying to understand the movement to distinguish between the leaders and the rank and file. When you're talking about the rank and file, you're talking about a very wide range of people with very different interests and backgrounds and ideas. So I think something to bear in mind that is that a substantial number of them do not support anything like a theocracy. And many of them would be unhappy to learn all of the details of what their leaders are proposing. A lot of them, when they're voting for leaders who promise to end abortion or reunite church and state, they're really voting on identity and not so much policy. Yeah. So they might agree with the idea, the general idea that America is a Christian nation, but they aren't explicitly aiming for major fundamental changes in the way government is organized. They're really just making a statement about who they are and what they value in themselves. So their ideas might, their identity might be sort of Christian nationalist, but really only in a loose way. But I think for leaders of the movement, like the heads of the right-wing policy groups and networking groups and media and legislative initiatives and the like, their vision really involves a lot more power for themselves and their networks and the political leaders that they support. Many of them, if you really dig into what they say, they look forward to a time when only Christians in their approved versions of the religion are in charge of all major areas of government and society. And when, you know, they're also looking for a time when they can, you know, look to the government for two things. Number one, a constant flow of taxpayer money. And number two, policies that privilege their religion.
Yeah, I think, you know, actually probably what they are going for, and they would even agree with the term, I think, is Christian government. That's really what they want, isn't it?
There are a lot of different terms that are in use. And, you know, I use a number of them in my book. And, you know, some of the terms that some people use are, I don't happen to use, but I think that, you know, we all have to use language that resonates with us. I think it's important to note that religious authoritarianism almost never leads to a pure theocracy, and it definitely doesn't lead to a Christian democracy. What it ends up leading to is a kind of kleptocracy, actually, often led by autocratic, irrational, often nepotistic leaders, where organized hypocrisy takes the place of religion.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. So if we, the bulk of your book is sort of looking at the development of the Christian nationalist movement, its various formative moments, its development of its power and so forth. Now, if we were to sort of unify that whole movement, you know, if we see there's a driving force behind it, what if from their point of view, because I know you did a lot of groundwork, let's say, kind of field work, talking to people, and so from their perspective, what do they see as the main problem in the politics? And I take it to heart too that there is a difference between the leadership and followership. So mm-hmm. So if you could even distinguish that, I think that'd be useful.
Well, what they would say is that they're in a war to the death against secularism. I mean, the movement has a lot of targets. They're always dividing, the us and the them, the pure from the impure. And they're focusing their grievances of their base on demonic or dehumanized others. So the number one threat, I think, as they see it, is secularism. I mean, there are plenty of other targets singled out for hate too. Progressive Christians and other progressive religious people receive a fair share of contempt. They're always being accused of promoting a false theology. Movement leaders are also decrying, America's religious minority groups sometimes. And they're constantly warning us against what they call radical feminists or LGBT totalitarians and things like that. But when they're looking for a single target to blame, an internal enemy upon whom to focus their rage and hate, it's often, people who are non-believers. And, they basically have, the aim of their movement is they're anti-pluralist and they're anti-equality. And so they need to find a sort of place in order, like a scapegoat in a way, upon whom to blame all of society's ills. And they often focus this on secularists who they say are out there ransacking everything that's holy and good in our society. As Franklin Graham said, progressive, that's just another word for godless. He's one of the sort of key sort of missionary sort of leaders and strategists. They're always conflating liberal and progressive politics with the absence of belief in their God. And I have to say, innumerable officials in the Trump administration are completely on board with this program. Like, think about Attorney General Bill Barr. He delivered an infamous speech at Notre Dame Law School, where he blamed secularists for what he called moral chaos and immense suffering, wreckage, and misery. And that sort of contributes to how he directs his Justice Department on matters, First Amendment matters.
From my perspective in looking at this, it's a really deep problem, actually, and I think it goes back all the way to the English Revolution. Mm. I mean, because a lot of times when we learn about this stuff in school, we sort of see, the forces of Parliament versus the forces of of the king, and that the Parliament were democratic forces, and we sort of project this modern liberalism onto them. But sometimes, I mean, when you look at Cromwell and the English Republic and stuff, I mean, they were pretty radical Puritans. They banned the celebration of Christmas because it was pagan. They smashed all the stained glass of the churches and defaced the statues, and like ISIS in so many ways, and in many ways, I think the American Revolution sort of continued this Puritan revolution and the Calvinist republics of Europe It's kind of like that movement went two ways, one in a sort of, secularist, radical, liberal, I don't know if radical is the right word, but let's say, a secular, liberal trend. And then I guess you have this Christian nationalist trend, and they're almost like, it's almost like, what is it, Ishmael and Jacob or something coming from the same descendant, and then warring. Do you see any sort of parallel with that, or sort of relevant to your work then?
Absolutely. I mean, the movement is really aiming squarely at pluralism, equality, and critical thinking, and the values of the Enlightenment above all. Those values are, ironically, are baked into our founding principles. They've been applied really imperfectly over time in so many ways, to be sure. But I think the extent to which we can pursue them, we spread, you know, spread justice and achieve great things. And when we try the opposite, religious authoritarianism, we spread injustice and pain. I think it's really interesting what you said about, you know, the monarchy. I think it's really relevant here. So I dug into, in the book, the sort of ideology of the movement leaders by focusing on a fellow named Ralph Dahlinger. He operates an organization called Capital Ministry. It's a ministry that targets political leaders at the highest levels of power. He has a Bible study taking place in the White House and U.S. Capitol. One of them has been attended by at least 12 out of 15 current and former members of Trump's cabinet. And, you know, his political theology is strikingly regressive. He thinks that government assistance to the poor, gun control, allowing women to teach men, or hiring non-Christians to work in government are all unbiblical. He's actually criticized sound environmental policy as a false theology. But I read a book that he wrote in which he's always talking about kings. Interestingly, there's a lot of talk about kings among some of the leaders of this movement. And here's the thing about kings, you know, and they're also comparing Trump often to biblical kings like King David or King Cyrus, an imperfect ruler through whom right. God is going to enact his will. But here's the thing about kings. Kings don't have to follow the rules. They are a law unto themselves, which yeah. makes them a sort of perfect ruler for an anti-pluralistic, anti-democratic movement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Now, you know, you've mentioned throughout the discussion so far, you know, a lot of specific people, a lot of actors, and definitely in your book, you do that. For the listeners right now, who would you say are some of the main actors, both existing right now and who are important in the present moment, but also, you know, looking back historically?
Well, I mean, there are just so many. It's, you know, hard to have a short list here.
If you were to choose three, let's say.
Well, I can't choose three. It's like, you know, asking me to choose three of my favorite children if I have like, you know, five dozen of them. But I will tell you about one of them, very important personality, a sort of mid-century theologian named Rusas John Rushdoony. The thing to know about him is he was really hostile to the principle of equality. He was a very influential theologian. A lot of his ideas and even a lot of the ways in which he expressed them have been adopted into the some of the most well-connected Christian nationalist leaders of today, people like David Barton. We can get into him afterwards. But let's talk about Rushdoony first. He was intensely hostile to the idea of equality. He endorsed an austere biblical literalism and rigid hierarchies, which he claimed were ordained by God. And he saw it as his job to rescue America from its commitment to what he called godless secularism. And his theology also included an opposition to government assistance to the poor. And he was a sort of, again, allied with that sort of super right-wing, hyper-libertarian economic wing of the Republican Party. He called social welfare programs, actually called them slavery to the state. So he shares a lot with the Christian nationalists of today, the idea of the United States as an authentically Christian nation, chosen by God to be an orthodox Christian republic, sort of the idea of a theology that demands absolute submission, the idea that at some point America deviated horribly from this mission and fell under the control of atheist and liberal elites. Sort of this was the life of Rushdoony's thought and remains a cornerstone of the thinking of a lot of the movement's leaders today. Now, one thing in particular he wrote mm-hmm. that has become a sort of an article of faith among the rank and file as the movement is that he wrote that the First Amendment aimed to establish religious freedom, he wrote, quote, not from religion, but for religion. So we hear this phrase widely parroted by movement leaders like David Barton all the time.
Right, right. And so let's see, you identify key points in the unfolding of this movement. Mm-hmm. You have like abortion, which we talked about, which would be from the 70s. And you also definitely go back to slavery And then, you know, your various chapters, like turning the states into laboratories, converting the flock to data, global holy war. Let's try to go through them bit by bit. Would you say, if we go, you know, the first step historically, chronologically speaking, would you say it's during the slavery era?
I think there have always been different strains of religious thought in American history over time. And we can look at the sort of difference between the abolitionist theologians and the pro-slavery theologians. As we know, there were theologians on both sides, and I write about many dozens of abolitionist theologians in my book, The Power Worshippers. I also write about the pro-slavery theologians, those who endorsed a very strict form of biblical literalism with the idea of hierarchies rooted in God. And so, you know, it's interesting. I'll see if I can find this quote. I'm going to grab my book right now.
Yeah, this is
the way sort of this, I write about in particular two pro-slavery theologians, Robert Louis Dabney and James Henley Thornwell. They were very two incredibly influential pro-slavery theologians that were allied on sort of the side of the slaveholders. So this is how James Henley Thornwell put it. He said, "The parties in this conflict," he was discussing the conflict between abolitionists and pro-slavery theology. He said, "The parties in this conflict are not merely abolitionists and slaveholders. They are atheists, socialists, communists, red Republicans on the one side, and friends of order and regulated freedom on the other." So he was actually conflating people who wanted to promote equality and end slavery with atheists and communists and socialists.
And this was like 1860s.
Right? Yeah, I don't have the exact, I'm looking at my footnote here, but I don't want to get lost in a, but we're talking, you know, in mid 80s.
But at the time, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But so, and then there were there were abolitionist theologians, but they were also on the whole on the side of women's rights too. A lot of them, like, you know, William Lloyd Garrison, I'm thinking about, like, I mean, think about this. Frederick Douglass famously supported women's suffrage. So, you know, Charles Grandison Finney, who was another abolitionist theologian, he encouraged female speakers at prayer meetings. And this drew the condemnation of conservatives who called his gatherings promiscuous assemblies. So I think it's, you know, important to note that, you know, Frederick Douglass said that, you know, he noted the influence of the abolitionist theologians, but he said, the ministers of high standing were almost to a man on the side of slavery. High standing, he meant the people who were well-funded, the rich ministers at that time. The establishment were really on the side of slavery. They were endorsing a kind of these kind of strict hierarchies and an alliance with what they called, you know, property, which of course included, very tragically, the property, the idea that other human beings could be the property of others. So some of these ideas have carried through to today. Now, I think it's really important when you're talking about the racial makeup of today's religious right. It's very different. I think, you know, the question of race is really critical here. And, you know, I want to get into that a little bit. I think that it's often characterized as a white movement. And for many, or perhaps even most people in the rank and file, it's an implicitly white movement, because I think for them, it's part of a vision that involves recovering a nation that was once supposedly both Christian and white. So it's a form of identity politics, tying America to a specific set of approved religious and cultural identities. I just want to say that, you know, leaders of the movement understand that the electoral future of the movement can't be ethnically homogenous. Look, they want to win elections. So in recent years, they've really tried to make an outreach effort to pastors of color in hopes of drawing in some number of their congregants. But, you know, there's an irony that these pastors are being enlisted to fight culture wars on behalf of this political party that engages in race-based gerrymandering and voter suppression. And of course, Trump appeals openly to the racism of so many of his followers And I think a lot of movement leaders sort of tend to paper over the ways in which hyper-conservative religion and racism reinforce each other.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to the way you do trace it, you know, the origins of this to the Civil War, because I mean the echoes of, you know, the American Civil War, you know, in so many ways, still are so powerful in the culture and politics, because yeah, that division between, you know, what is America, what is Christianity in America as well, really, you know, you're right. I think that, you know, that debate is, you know, although, you know, one would have thought it would have been resolved by the war, by that bloody war, it's still there. That tension is still unresolved.
Exactly. I mean, you look, you know, a century later, we can look at people like Bob Jones Sr., you know, who was when his educational establishment was threatened, that sort of was so upsetting to the leaders in the New Right. He actually called segregation God's established order. And he referred to, it's the same kind of thing. He referred to desegregationists as satanic propagandists and religious infidels who are trying to overthrow the established order of God. It's the insistence that they think they know what God's order is and that God is on the side of you know, hierarchies of value. These hierarchies are established right by God. And you see some of these ideas perpetuated by movement leaders today. They're a little bit too savvy to try to do it around race. They certainly do it still around gender.
Right, right. And so we talked earlier about how abortion was used to sort of coalesce and propel the moral majority in the 70s. And then other chapters you have are like turning states into laboratories. Can you expand on that? That's an interesting concept.
Is that this chapter I do about Project Blitz? I don't have like the chapter list in front of me.
Yeah. Turning states into laboratories of theocracy. Sorry, I used the British pronunciation.
No, that's quite all right. So Project Blitz is a broad-based legislative initiative, and I want to talk about that for a moment because it's really interesting. Are you familiar with the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, or there's an anti-abortion organization called Americans United for Life. These are right-wing organizations that craft pieces of model legislation. They allow legislators to easily introduce bills in different states without needing to actually research and write the bills themselves. It kind of gets all these different legislators on the right on the same, you know, with the same political vision on the same page. So Project Blitz works along similar lines. The idea is to overwhelm state legislators with legislatures with so many religiously themed bills that some of them can be expected to get through, and the center of debate on certain issues gets shifted to the right. So the ultimate aim for this Project Blitz, it was actually a document that a number of religious right leaders collaborated on, showing model legislation and sort of talking about their aims. The ultimate aim for them was to get this license for certain faith groups, conservative Christian groups, to discriminate against certain other groups and to conflate in the minds of the public their religion with the authority of government. It's basically, you know, the aim is a way of signaling to everyone through the law that there's a group in America that's privileged and authentically American and other groups that are not deserving of privilege and not deserving of rights. So sometimes when these bills are, you know, put through by legislators, let's just give you an example, like an In God We Trust bill, like the one piece of the model legislation is very detailed, number of different types of piece, but one piece was like, we want to get In God We Trust signs put up in every public school and they have to be a certain size. So a lot of people might see this bill and say, oh, In God We Trust, what's the harm of putting a God We Trust sign up in every public schools? And so people would sort of look at this in a sort of individual fashion. Some people might think it's not a big deal. Other people might think, well, it's not really religiously inclusive, is it? What about kids who aren't, what kind of God are we implying, et cetera? We've got diverse, you know, kids of different diverse backgrounds. But, you know, the fact is that the larger document shows that these bills are pieces of a larger puzzle. And they show us that the religious right understands that these bills not only relate to each other, but that they further their broader political vision.
Right, right. And another chapter you have here, which is interesting, and I think it's important for, you know, the insight it provides to converting the flock to data. That's because, you know, a lot of times people think of, you know, the religious right as, you know, being a Southern redneck, Hicks, uneducated, right? And all those negative stereotypes. But in fact, you know, a lot of them are very technologically savvy, early adopters, pioneers in a lot of fields. So I think that, you know, when you speak about this converting flock to data, it kind of highlights their tech savviness. Can you expand on it a little bit more?
It really does. I mean, thanks for bringing that up. I think the idea that the religious right is sort of, you know, I think a lot of the progressives misunderstand the sophistication of the movement. So in my, there are all these data initiatives that I write about in my book. And one of the organizations I focus on is called United in Purpose. It's a data initiative that aims to turn out the vote for the hyper-conservative candidates that the movement favors. And a lot of the founder of the organization is a fellow called Bill Dallas. And he's actually described the incredibly broad reach that his organization has in the in data and voter files. He gave an interview in 2016 in which he said, we have 200 million, this is sort of, I'm doing this by memory, so it might not be an exact quote. He said something like, we have 200 million voter files in our databases, and we know what makes someone turn out to vote one way or not vote at all. I mean, think about that. And then they use this very careful social, profiling, you know, psychological profiling. They know what people are, you know, members of conservative churches. They know what people are fans of NASCAR or fishing. You know, things like this, they can suss this from people's social media posts and things like that. They know whether people have ever signed an anti-marriage equality list or an anti-abortion list. So they basically assign points to people, as Bill Dallas has explained. And if people...
How do they get this data?
Well, you know, a lot of the stuff is available through voter rolls, through membership, church membership lists. One of the things that they do is they offer conservative pastors a list of voter rolls and list of church membership. And so then they show the pastor what percentage of his congregation voted in the last election. They can actually do that. I mean, there's all kinds of crazy data available online.
Yeah.
I mean, there's, you know, there, it's basically a data mining organization intending to turn out voters of what they call voters of faith for the so-called right candidates.
Right. Interesting.
And all political parties of all persuasions, of course, now rely on data to sharpen their effectiveness in elections. But the difference with an organization like United in Purpose is they're working with a lot of church organizations and religious organizations. So they're on top of a long pyramid that's largely operating in the religious sphere, which is largely exempt from taxes and public scrutiny. So that's a big difference, the fact that they're working through church organizations in that way.
Mm-hmm. And now the final chapter in your book is something I'd like to expand on a little too. Global Holy War Comes of Age. The international links, and you know, you mentioned like Orban and Putin and I suppose, you know, some people, you know, put in, you mentioned Erdogan in Turkey. I know some people would include Netanyahu there and so forth. And where, what is the, so just outline your argument there for us, please.
Sure. I mean, under Trump, the United States has really become a key player of this new tactical alliance. They call themselves a global conservative movement. They often unite over claims that they want to defend the family, but really it's about taking down modern democracy and replacing it with authoritarian faith-based ethno-states. These movements tend to have, you know, nuances specific to different countries. They certainly advocate for different policies in these areas. I'd be happy to talk about that. But each defines itself against a single common worldwide enemy, which is global liberalism, equality, and the values of the Enlightenment. So one of the things I did in this chapter when I was reporting it is I went to an annual conference of this movement. It was called the World Congress of Families. It got its start over 20 years ago when American and Russian activists gathered in Russia to talk about areas of mutual interest, and sort of grown now into this conference that takes place, I wouldn't say annually, but sometimes biannually.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I actually interviewed Brian Brown.
Oh, wow. Yeah. What was that like?
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. So right. It's this global movement.
That yeah. That's great. Wow. That's very cool. So yeah, I mean, I heard, you know, for instance, a popular right-wing American radio host describe the group as being in a war with he called it the anti-cultural processes of globalization and its secular aristocracy. So then speaker after speaker hit familiar targets, the radical feminists, the abortion industry, and what they called LGBT totalitarians. And they were always, you know, telling us to sort of break the ice cap of political correctness and, you know, to make law, you know, liberal politicians fear us. But, you know, they really have this kind of unmistakable vision about, you know, taking down liberal democracy and replacing it with a kind of much more authoritarian form of governance bolstered by a sort of religious conservatives. I think.
How do you see their relationship with the alt-right?
There's a lot of connections, and I discovered some of those connections when I was sitting one day in an outdoor cafe within spitting distance of the convention center, and I saw a fellow named Ed Martin. I described this in my book, sitting down with a Polish far-right politician named Dominik Tarczyński. And they were sort of talking about some, you know, issues that they wanted to collaborate on. And Ed Martin, he's the head of the Eagle Forum. It's one of sort of Phyllis Schlafly's organizations. And Ed Martin used to be a commentator and on CNN, and he sort of has ties to the Republican Party. And they were talking about Ed Martin was sort of instructing him to tag Jack Posobiec, who is like this sort of conspiracy theorist, alt-right conspiracy theorist, in one of his posts. So, mm-hmm. you know, I wouldn't say the religious right is the same as the alt-right, but there are a lot of connections. If you look at a Venn diagram, you're going to see a lot of areas of interest. And I just want to point out there's a new book by a wonderful writer named Sarah Posner that just came out. You should invite her onto your show. She writes explicitly about those links. She's done a lot of research into them.
Right. So where do you see Christian nationalism going? Do you see it getting stronger, more organized, or what? What do you see the direct? You, I mean, you've charted its history, you've charted its growth. What's its future?
I mean, I think the future of this movement is what we allow it to be. You know, the question is, are we going to continue down the same path that we've been on, or are we going to be able to organize in order to, you know, reject the politics of conquest and division that this movement represents, and be able to enact meaningful political change?
Right. So, in sum, what message would you like to leave your readers with after, you know, they've read your book?
Well, the challenges that this movement represents are political, and I think the solutions are political too. There are things that we can do as individuals, and there are things that we can do collectively in groups. The right has invested for decades in, you know, data, media, and messaging, and all of the tools of modern political campaigns. They're using the tools of democracy to destroy democracy. And I think these same tools can be used to restore it.
All right. Well, thanks so much for this interview. And actually, before we go, let me just ask you, I mean, I know you're constantly active. Are you working on anything right now? Any project?
Thank you so much for asking. I continue to write articles about this movement and different aspects of it and how it's influencing the politics today.
Okay, good, good. Well, again, thanks so much for this interview. It's been really informative and enjoyable.
Thank you so much. Likewise.
Once again, the book is The Power Worshippers: Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. And we've been speaking to the author, Catherine Stewart. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure too. Thank you.
That's all for Politics and Polemics this week. If you like this, remember to check out my other podcast, Independent Thought and Freedom, and subscribe to my YouTube channel. Also, if you are an academic and want to get heard nationally, check out my free training at becomeapublicintellectual.com. Thanks, and see you next week.